garment, for the patch will pull away from the garment, making the tear worse. Neither do men pour new wine into old wineskins. If they do, the skins will burst, the wine will run out, and the wineskins will be ruined. No, they pour new wine into new wineskins, and both are preserved. While he was saying this, a ruler came and knelt before him and said, "My daughter has just died, but come and put your hand on her, and she will live." Jesus got up and went with him, and so did his disciples. Just then, a woman who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak. She said to herself, "If I only touch his cloak, I will be healed." Jesus turned and saw her. "Take heart, daughter," he said, "your faith has healed you." And the woman was healed from that moment. When Jesus entered the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the noisy crowd, he said, "Go away, the girl is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took the girl by the hand, and she got up. News of this spread through all that region.
Please. Good morning, it's good to see you all here. My name's John Byrne, I'm one of the leaders here at the Village Church. And we've been looking over the last couple of months here at the Village Church and across the Kensington congregations at who Jesus is, looking at what he did to show us who he is. He was not just a good teacher, though he was that. He was not just a prophet, though he was that too. But we've seen, as we've been looking together at Matthew chapters 8 and 9 over the last couple of months, that he displayed a power and made claims that can only be described as divine. And yet, he managed to totally annoy the religious authorities of his day. He touched people like lepers, and yet didn't seem to be bothered with the prevailing belief of the time that he himself would be made unclean by touching them. Instead, when he touched them, they were healed and made clean. He claimed to forgive sins, a power that the teachers of the law rightly attributed to God alone. But he proved his authority to forgive by healing the paralyzed man that he'd just spoken to. He ate with tax collectors and sinners, and when criticized, he said he'd come for the sick, not the healthy, to call sinners, not those who thought they were righteous. His disciples didn't fast like serious Jews were supposed to. Why were they so irreligious? It was as shocking as if in a Muslim culture today, somebody didn't keep Ramadan. Everybody would know about it. He said it was because they were celebrating the fact that he was with them. And then, as we saw last week, he said that he'd not come to patch up the old, but to make things completely new. That's not the kind of thing that conservative religious leaders want to hear. It doesn't sound orthodox. It sounds revolutionary. But their opposition was tempered by the facts before them. He healed people. He drove out demons. They couldn't find any moral fault in him, apart from the fact that he wasn't like them. And he had no desire to join their exclusive religious club. And that always annoys people who think they're special. So the question Matthew is leading us to now is, were there limits to the power of Jesus? Was there anything that could defeat even his ability to do miracles? Because if there was, then he couldn't be divine. His claims to forgive would have been nonsense, and everyone could go back to the treadmill of a works-based religion and pretending to be better than they really were. That's where we are this morning, facing the big question, the one everyone avoids. The reason why people spend a fortune on health care and gym membership and trying not to look their age. Death. It's coming to us all, and we'd rather not think about it or face it just yet. But we know it. We've seen it, and we know in our grief that it's the most painful thing in the whole of existence. Does Jesus have an answer for that? If he doesn't, then we can just walk away this morning and dismiss the whole thing as nonsense. But if he does have the answer, then none of us can afford to ignore him. Let's look then at what Matthew is telling us this morning. And to do that, I'm going to consider in turn the three people that we encounter in this passage. There's the man, the ruler who comes to him, the woman who interrupts them on the way, and the girl who's lying dead in her bed when they get there. First of all then, the man. Verse 18. While he was saying this, a ruler came and knelt before him and said, "My daughter has just died, but come and put your hand on her and she will live." Jesus got up and went with him, and so did his disciples. Verse 18 presents an unlikely scenario. One of the rulers, the very people who've been opposing Jesus and criticizing him throughout these chapters, came and knelt before him. The word translated as knelt here has a sense of kneeling in worship. This is what the Magi did when they came to the infant Jesus. It's the same word. Mark's account of this episode gives the man a name, Jairus, and tells us that seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him. But as we're drawn into this desperate scene, Matthew's already put it in context for us. While he was saying this, whenever you see a phrase like that in Scripture, you should always start asking questions. If it's therefore, since, because of this, so, while. Whenever you see words like that, obvious questions should come into your mind. Like, while he was saying what? That's why I asked our reading to actually start a few verses before the passage that we're looking at. Because what he had been saying, we looked at last week, verse 16 and 17. "No one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch will pull away from the garment, making the tear worse. Neither do men pour new wine into old wineskins. If they do, the skins will burst, the wine will run out, and the wineskins will be ruined. No, they pour new wine into new wineskins, and both are preserved." Jesus is saying that he's not come to reform Judaism, to make us better able to keep the law of Moses. That would be pouring new wine into old wineskins. He has come to make us completely new, to bring us into a new relationship with God that's not based on our miserable record of trying and failing, but on what he's going to do for us. There are two things we all need, and it's not sex and money. Two things that drive people to seek for meaning in life, even when they look sometimes in the most unpromising or ridiculous places. And that's forgiveness for our sins and an end to the fear of death. If Jesus can't deliver here, then there's no point in Matthew writing anymore, or in us reading any further. I should have stayed home this morning and watched the Great British Bake Off. Because if Jesus can't pour new wine into new wineskins, new life into new lives, then life really doesn't have much more point than daytime television. So that's the context and the challenge when this synagogue ruler comes and throws himself down at Jesus' feet and begs for him to do something. Where else can he turn? Mark's account, as usual, is longer and tells us the girl was still dying when Jairus first turned up and news of her passing reached them while Jesus was on his way to the house. Sorry, my phone's going off in my pocket. You take it. It might be important because we have a pregnant daughter in Canada who might be, things might be happening. Right, where was I? Sorry about that. Um, Okay, the context and the challenge that this synagogue ruler comes and throws himself down at Jesus' feet and begs for him to do something because his daughter is dying, if not dead yet. Where else can he turn? Mark tells us that the girl was still dying when Jairus first turned up and news of her passing reached them while Jesus was on his way to the house. And Matthew doesn't bother going into all those details. The fact is that by the time Jesus got there, the girl was dead. But let's get back to this ruler, Jairus. It's obvious why he's there. He's desperate. There's nothing more desperate than a dying child. We aren't meant to bury our children. But even with all our medical advances and the National Health Service, many of us still do. In the UK, fewer than 1 in 200 children die. In Afghanistan today, it's 1 in 7. Even that's an improvement on what it used to be there. And tons better than conditions were in the times of the Roman Empire when Matthew was writing. One source estimates that around 25% of babies in the first century AD did not survive their first year. And up to half of all children died before the age of 10. So what was happening here was a reality for every mother and father in that crowd. They all knew this grief. They all knew this despair. This was what life was like. Not debating contrary theories of the nature of God in some interfaith dialogue. They needed to see that the power of God was with Jesus, and he wasn't just another celebrity rabbi who had a way with words. But Jairus had seen that power, and instead of taking offense like many of the religious leaders and Pharisees as the new wine of Jesus burst their old wineskins of legalism, he'd thought about it and prayed about it so that now, facing the greatest crisis of his life, he knew there was only one person he could turn to. We've seen great examples of faith in these chapters. The leper who says to Jesus, "Lord, if you're willing, you can make me clean." The centurion who believed Jesus could heal his servant with just a word. The four friends of the paralyzed man who were so sure Jesus could heal him that they forced their way into the house through the roof. And we might think that compared to the centurion who said, "Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but say the word and my servant will be healed." We might think that Jairus was somehow lacking in faith, that he didn't react in the same way when he asked Jesus to physically come with him to the house. But he was asking for so much more. Both the centurion and Jairus had seen the evidence that Jesus could heal the sick. And that's, at first, all that Jairus was asking for. But Matthew tells us, in his condensed version of the story, that he did ask Jesus to raise her when he knew of his daughter's death. He comes and says, "My daughter has just died, but come and put your hand on her and she will live." This is stepping up a level to ask him to raise the dead. That was amazing faith. Both men displayed a faith that's greater than any of ours, the centurion and Jairus. We might pray that God would heal the sick. We do it fairly regularly. But let's be honest, we're usually surprised when it happens. It does happen, but our faith isn't usually very strong. I doubt that any of us has ever dared to pray that he would raise the dead. But Jesus doesn't send Jairus away and tell him not to be ridiculous. We read, Jesus got up and went with him. Now that must have given him hope. After all, no one had ever seen Jesus fail. If he was coming to the house, then everything would be all right, wouldn't it? I think Jairus would have wanted Jesus to run with him back to the house at that point. But the crowds were too great. People were pushing and shoving each other, trying to get close enough to see Jesus for themselves, or perhaps even to touch him. You know how frustrating it can get when you're in a hurry to get somewhere, but there are people in the way everywhere. Imagine that magnified by the fact that you think your hurrying is a matter of life and death. And then Jesus stops and we encounter the woman. Just then a woman who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak. She said to herself, "If only I touch his cloak, I will be healed." Then Jesus turned and saw her. "Take heart, daughter," he said, "your faith has healed you." And the woman was healed from that moment. Now, why is this story of the woman being healed stuck into the middle of this account of Jesus raising a child from the dead? Because that's what life is like. Events interrupt our greatest priorities, like my phone going off just now. We can't plan for these things. And we all struggle with that. The gospel account is nothing if not realistic. Jesus was on his way. Jairus was beginning to get his hopes up. And then this wretched, unclean woman comes along and ruins everything. He must have wanted to scream. Is that how we react when we face distractions from what we think is God's perfect will? Or delays in getting what we want from him in prayer? Do the circumstances of life, and worse, the realities of death, bring us to that point of despair? I know that's how I react all too often. I say I believe in the sovereignty of God, but I still get irritated when the lights turn red just as I approach them. Or the car in front doesn't move off fast enough when they turn green again. The American preacher and conference speaker Paul Tripp has an illustration where he shakes a bottle of water and some of it spills out. And he then asks the question, "Why did water come out of the bottle?" And the usual reply is, "Because you shook it." "No," he says, "it's because there was water in the bottle." My impatience isn't caused by the traffic lights changing. That's just what shakes it out of me. Sadly, it doesn't take much. So I can easily imagine Jairus' thoughts at this time, if he was anything like me. Mark records that it was only after this delay in their journey that news reaches Jairus that his daughter is not just dying, but has now actually died. And they were on the way. And this woman comes along. Just imagine his feelings. It's too late now. Jairus must have shown on his face, that's what he thought, that the healer had been delayed and that now the situation was irretrievable. But Jesus says to him, "Don't be afraid, just believe." But let's get back to the woman who caused this delay. Her story's there for a purpose, not just as an interruption. We're told that she had been bleeding for 12 years. Now, it's not just that she would have been feeling weak and chronically anemic. In that society, a woman was considered to be unclean for 7 days every month while she had her period. This poor woman had been unclean for years. She wasn't allowed to be in the company of men, let alone to touch one of them. That's why she was so secretive about what she was doing, coming up behind him to touch his cloak. What she does in touching Jesus would, in the eyes of the Pharisees, have also made Jesus unclean. We see that theme many times through this chapter, that Jesus isn't bothered by what society considers unclean. He's not bothered about being contaminated himself in some way. And yet, as we saw before when Jesus touched the leper, she's the one who's made clean by her contact with him. Her bleeding stops immediately, and she knows it. She suddenly feels well again for the first time in over a decade. What Jesus says to her next is very significant. "Your faith has healed you." In other words, she's now made clean. It's not the legalism of the Pharisees that helped her. That just declared her unfit for the company of men. It was her faith in the power and grace of Jesus. By pouring the new wine of his healing love and mercy into her life, Jesus has burst the old wineskin of legalism that gave her nothing but condemnation. And let's not make no mistake about this. This is another example of great faith. She'd been told so often that she was unclean that she must have believed it. How many of us have thought that we can't come to God? That we can't approach Jesus because we're not good enough? Maybe some of us here still think that. The thing is, we can never make ourselves good enough. This poor woman had tried. Mark tells us in his account, she had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. Now, we might not have a physical ailment like that, but isn't that very common when we try to make ourselves better? Instead of getting better, we just see ourselves getting worse. These outward rules of uncleanness that the Pharisees majored in were given to teach the Jews the concept of inner uncleanness and our inability to approach God in our own merits. But they twisted that. They thought they could keep the rules and make themselves right before God by it, and that was never the purpose of the law. Now, we might find that what the Pharisees were doing is illogical, maybe even ridiculous today. But we can so easily replace their rules with rules and superstitions of our own. Like, if I go to church more often, God will answer my prayers. Or, if I give to children in need, that will make up for spending so much on myself this month. Or, if I read the Bible every day, God will like me. Now, I'm not saying don't come to church or read your Bible or give to children in need, but nothing we can ever do is enough to make us right with God. We're all like this woman, chronically unclean and in need of a touch from Jesus. And so her faith is very great. Despite what everybody else would think of her, she knows that what she needs is Jesus, and so she comes to him. And immediately he receives her, acknowledges her faith, and makes her well, makes her clean again. No matter how we feel about ourselves, or whatever others may say about us, Jesus will accept us. And he's the only one who can make us clean. We just have to come to him in faith. This woman's healing is an example of new wine in a new wineskin. The old wineskin of the law and its demands just broke her. Her encounter with Jesus has made her new. That's what he can do for each of us if we come to him in faith. Even weak faith, secretive faith, that doesn't want to let anyone else know that we're there. Jesus still listens to that. And then Jesus moves on again. He hasn't forgotten what Jairus had asked of him. He hasn't used up his grace or his healing power, because he's the eternal Son of God walking among them. And he moves on with Jairus back to his house. Verse 23, when Jesus entered the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the noisy crowd, he said, "Go away. The girl is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took the girl by the hand, and she got up. News of this spread through all that region. We come to the crucial test here, the climax of the passage that we're looking at this morning. Jesus enters the house where the girl has recently died. You can imagine the scene, I'm sure. The despair and grief of the family must have been overwhelming. And to add to that, professional mourners had arrived, the flute players and the noisy crowd. Professional mourners were used at that time like we might hire a band or a singer at a wedding. A funeral was a big thing with the whole town involved, and it would take place on the day of the death to avoid the smell of decomposition in the house. There were no undertakers or funeral parlours or chapels of rest. The old wineskin is now exhausted, dried up and empty. The girl has died. That's the end of it. There's no more anyone can do. The mother would have been weeping over the body as she tenderly prepared it for burial. Her prayers unanswered. Her hopes dashed. The community around her couldn't offer her any hope, just a sharing in her grief. And then in walks this man that her husband has brought home, and he drives out the flute players and the weeping women, saying, "Go away, the child is not dead, but asleep." What lunacy is this? Where did Jairus find this crazy man? We all know that where there's life, there's hope, but she was dead. There was no hope left. Everyone knows that death is final. And so they laughed at him, even though the situation wasn't at all funny. Is that your reaction when you hear the Christian message of life after death and hope eternal? The crowd in Jairus' house certainly thought there was nothing Jesus could do, that death was the final problem that not even he could solve. But you have a choice to make. If death is the end for everybody and there's nothing more, then you have nothing to lose in rejecting the gospel. But if there is more, if there is a resurrection and a judgment, you have everything to lose if you don't put your faith in Jesus. Or maybe you believe in life after death and heaven, but you're living under the delusion that you can do enough to get there on your own. Like the Pharisees with their rule keeping, or the woman spending 12 years in all her money trying to get better before she eventually came to Jesus. In telling the crowd to go, Jesus is trying to get some privacy for what he's going to do next. He isn't trying to impress the crowd. That's not what he's about. How often do we see him telling people that he's healed to tell no one? He wants to deal with compassion as he talks to this father and mother and helps their little girl. That's how he deals with us, individually and tenderly. And then he takes the girl by the hand. Again, this was shocking. You just didn't touch a dead body unless it was a close member of the family and you absolutely had to. That really was a taboo in that culture. And then the unthinkable happens. Instead of Jesus being made unclean by touching her, she gets up. She's made alive again. Jesus is not just pouring out new wine, he's making new wineskins. So, what does that tell us? Is death the final chapter? Could Jesus have prevented this little girl from dying? Yes. And he could have done it without even going to the house. What happened to the girl after this? She grew up and then she died. It happens to us all. So what was the point? By bringing her back to life, Jesus proved that death is not the end, and he has power over it. What should concern us is not death, but what happens afterwards. What Jesus has shown in all this is that he can conquer even the last barrier, death. That's not much good, you might be saying, if he only raises people so they can die again.